Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Dr. Sandra Bonura on the show. Dr. Bonura is a historian and frequent storyteller on the importance of using a multitude of primary sources to gain perspective on historical events. She's the author of two recent books, which we will discuss in today's podcast, including Empire Builder, John D. Spreckles and the Making of San Diego, and then her more recent book, The Sugar King of California, The Life of Klaus Spreckles. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. I had a lot of fun talking about a wide range of subjects with Dr. Bonura. Let's go meet her. What's it like to grow up on Coronado, and how did that shape how you see the world?
I didn't actually grow up on Coronado. I was born and raised on the other side of the bridge in San Diego. However, my mother worked for the Navy her whole life. So she worked at North Island. So that was part of my childhood. And my birthday is December 1st. So every December I'm at the Hotel del Coronado throughout my childhood. So it's just a part of my DNA. And today I'm there every week. I'm in Coronado. So it's a part. I like things that don't change. Because San Diego is such a vibrant tourist community. I like to go to those places that still look like they did when I was a child. Babel Park, Coronado, Old Town, things like that. I don't know if it shaped my worldview, but Coronado is not the conservative Navy town today. It was when I grew up.
Let's chart the path from your background in education, getting a doctorate in education, as also school counseling, to making a transition to writing history. How did that happen?
I always knew I wanted to be a teacher. That was for sure. But when in my era, only the boys went into history. So in colleges, I got a K-8 multiple subject. I was going to teach elementary school, but I always loved history. And definitely, I can remember being told, you had to get a single supplement in a subject. I said, I'd like to teach history. Oh, and then only the men get those jobs. And so I was shuffled off to elementary school. When my own formative years, history was the only class I shone in. History and writing, that's it. Otherwise, I was like a C average student. It's still the same today. History and writing, that's my loves. And so I'm living the dream. I'm living the Sandy Bonura dream.
Let's talk about some things that I read on your website, which I think is a helpful kind of framing for some broader things that we'll talk about. So one of the things that you mentioned right there on your opening statement on your site is that certain pioneers, important kind of figures early on in the history of California, have been neglected. Why do you think that is?
I think the number one reason I have discovered is their descendants. Did they have descendants to carry on their legacy? When I began writing about missionary teachers, I would find a lot more information from those who had children, particularly daughters, for some weird reason. And in the Spreckles family, for example, they've been forgotten because of all the lawsuits and all the terrible drama and the fracturing within the family. The people they married didn't want to even hear the name Spreckles or associate it. So they're forgotten. And when I wrote the first book on San Diego, it's a big seller here in San Diego. I spoke last week in a library. Out of 100 people, 3/4 had read Empire Builder.
Wow.
And wow, that's a lot. That's a lot. That says a lot statistically how many people. Because he built our city from infrastructure to superstructure. Yet nobody knows who he was.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I've found in talking to people that write about kind of these central figures, these historical figures that kind of charted the course of a large place like San Diego, is that they tend to fall into two camps typically. You have hagiography, where you see everything that the person does is turning to gold, the touch, Midas touch. There are these perfect, amazing figures, the great man theory of history, where you overlook the negative aspects. And then on the flip side, you have this kind of newer tendency, these kind of hit job style biographies where you just list out their sins, almost like they were in a confession booth. And so I don't think either of those is a very good approach to writing history. And how do you thread that needle between overlooking some of the negative aspects, but then also avoiding just listing out imperfections?
Any good historian loves to find dirt. I love me some dirt. And when I find it, I don't sanitize it, but I present it as if I'm Switzerland. And I also don't tell when my some of my books have gone out for review. Some of the reviewers' comments would be like, I want Sandy Bonner to make more sense of that deal that he had or that situation. I want her to synthesize it. Someone a long time ago told me, Sandy, don't do that. Let the reader figure it out, him or herself. Let them feel smart when they, oh, that's why you did that, because your father did that 20 years ago. Oh, that's why you did that. So I have worked very hard to lose the voice of my dissertation committee, who didn't want to hear me. They wanted me to stand on the shoulders of giants that came before me and give them all their credit. I have learned to tell a story very anecdotally. I don't dumb down history, but I just present it. I like to present their facts, their sins, everything, and let people decide who's a saint and who's a sinner. Everyone has their own context reading. So I'm very aware when I write books that I'm writing only for a reader. And because I've been a college professor and a teacher my whole life, practically, I just look at the readers as my students. What do you want to know? So I provide a lot of rich context with my books. Rich. I want them to know what's going on all around the subject of my biography. And you decide. They need to know the era. They need to understand the era that my subjects were in. And that's fun. And I think that's why a lot of book clubs can use my book, which is shocking to me. I never realized book clubs would. Nonfiction books aren't your hot ones for books. But the way I write, I leave you hanging from the next chapter and get you excited about what's coming up. It's, I don't know if that even answered your question.
No, I think it's great. I was just listening to an interview with Max Boot, who just published the brand new, what probably will be definitive biography of Ronald Reagan. And one of the things he was talking about is that Reagan is the perfect character to see this kind of chasm between the hit jobs and the hagiography. You have one particular political persuasion that just wants to turn him into the perfect man, the perfect president. And then another side, they're just going to list out his sins. And so doing good history is sidestepping both of those and choosing a middle path where you try to, like you said, just give the facts, but also frame it in a way where people can come to their own conclusions. So it is a struggle. I think my generation struggles with presentism, this idea that we should judge people of history by the standards of the present. And I think that leads to a whole bunch of errors, not only just kind of navel gazing, but also not understanding the context, the cultural environment in which someone was brought up and the kind of assumptions that they carry on. But let's go on to our next question, which is, go ahead. Go ahead.
What said?
Oh, thank you.
I'm applauding you.
I've been preaching that sermon for a long time. What? Okay. So next question is about another thing you mentioned on your site as a kind of a part of your statement on there is about how colorful and incredible the various writers across times and different groups around writing around California history. And I was just curious about how you situate what you're doing within the kind of broader writing about the state, if there are certain North Stars in terms of writing about California or the West that guided you, and how you think about the role that your books have in that discussion.
When you're saying what stars, do you mean what people have?
Yeah, so it was a little bit of a pun on Kevin Starr a little bit, but yeah, how you situate where your writing fits in that world.
Well done. Get with the two R's.
Yeah.
I really, to be completely transparent, nobody inspired me. I didn't start reading California history until I had to write about California history. And of course, I'm not going to write present. I'm going to go back. I like primary source. Mm-hmm. I get my best history from newspapers. Thank goodness we have Chronicling America and the Riverside, these digitized newspapers of the day. I like my reader. I want my readers to figure out stuff. I want to figure out stuff too. Part of the journey of the book is also for me. So I can read, and if Kevin Starr has a good statistic, I'll use it. He said, but I'm going to go and find. We keep repeating the same errors in California history, I've discovered, the same quotes. That's wrong. But we keep citing people's work. So you'll see very little of that in my books. Gotcha. Mine are, so I'm not sure that answered as well, but that's my view. I don't really follow anyone. No one's really inspired me. I'm inspired by the whole breadth and width of California historians. And I feel blessed and honored that I live in an era where I can use the internet. When I first started researching, I had to go to put dimes in the thermal, in the fax. What do you call that thing? Was it in the library, you know, slide the things across. Oh my gosh. Now, as I progressed, as books went along, now I can just call up these beautiful digitized places. The other people before me, they didn't have that. I can't imagine. I'm so in awe of them. I'm actually in awe. God bless them.
Yeah.
God bless them.
It's a lot of work. And I think about how blessed I am. I was working with a gentleman in the area where I live in the Central Valley that was, he was trying to conduct, it was partly genealogical research, but also just looking into the history where he lives. And he was talking to me about looking through microfilm. And then I explained to him that I actually digitized that newspaper that he wanted to search through. And I showed him what happens if you tap in Control F and you can do keyword searches. He about fell out of his chair in excitement when I, it's always fun. Let's transition though, because I want to talk about Hawaii now. How did you find yourself doing research on Ida May Pope and schools in Hawaii? What's the connection there? And how did you get drawn to that project?
Oh, that's an interesting story. So my husband's a geologist, and he worked with another engineering geologist whose wife was the Scripps Institution of Oceanography archivist. And she was just looking at retirement. And during a company picnic, we're both at, I got to telling her my love of teaching in Hawaii, blah, blah, blah. And she said, I have some letters that you might be interested to read. So at that time, I was a professor at Chapman University, and the email came in my office. And I go, oh, she wants me to read these letters. I remember her. So I printed it. I had no idea it was going to be the size of the Los Angeles phone book. I'm like trying to hide all the printing I'm doing in my office. It's private. So no, what is she doing? We had to be very careful about using our personal our Xerox machines to our personal. So anyways, when I read those letters, and it wasn't only until my mother was dying and I needed a distraction, it was about 2008, I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to read these letters because I just need not to think about anything else. I was absolutely enthralled. She got these letters from an attic in Berkeley. It was a very famous house built by a Julia Morgan. Pretty significant female, you probably know. Anyways, she traveled up to the house to get this collection for Scripps because the house was owned by one of the co-founders of Scripps Institution of Oceanography. When it came to San Diego, they were cataloging all the scientific oceanography material. And this was an anomaly. One of the trunks held all this rare Hawaiiana, those handwritten love letters from a missionary teacher to her fiance at then Harvard. He was getting a zoology degree of all things. I started reading them. I was absolutely hooked because who writes letters anymore? And these were like 1890 to 1894. And she's in Honolulu at a girls' boarding school chronicling the coup d'etat that took the queen down. She's interacting with the queen. She's interacting with the king. She goes to the king's funeral. I'm like, oh, Hawaiian monarchy. And so I asked the Scripps Institution of her archivist, I said, do you mind if I edit these letters? I think we have a book here. She says, it's not a book. I'm like, you know what? I've never been so enthralled in my life. I think people would be very interested in this. We decided to partner together. And I edited those letters, but before I could edit a single name out, because she was also a journalist for the Hartford Courant, she's telling America what is going on in Hawaii at the same time she's writing love letters and talking about whipping these little girls to death. Oh, it's just such a story. So this is an epistolary. So it was just her letters I edited. But when I took out all the names from home, I had to learn who were these players? Who were these people? And before you know it, there's nothing I don't know about the people who overthrew through the government. I had every man. I researched all their family. Deborah did the same. And I submitted it to the University of Hawaii Press. And it went through its review and it ultimately became a book. And in that book, during the letter reading, of Carrie Winter, Ida May Polk kept jumping out. All these Congregationalist missionaries were the ones going into Hawaii. Ida May Polk was cut from a different cloth. She was not a Republican. She was a Democrat. She was from Chicago. And she was a Presbyterian, which is, you know, be a Presbyterian, Episcopalian, Hawaii at the time. So anyway, she was jumping into my heart. And I was just so in love with this woman who gave 25 years of her life for the Hawaiian girls who, let's go, she was a feminist in every which way. And she loved God too. I just fell in love with her. And so I began my journey back to Hawaii, researching out to Ohio where she was from. And she didn't have children. So I had to find the descendants of her one married sister. And in the Civil War, when you're writing about ladies in the Civil War, they didn't get married and have kids because 700,000 men were lost in the Civil War. So it's real challenging to find people in my era who had descendants. So anyways, and when I'm in Hawaii and I'm in the archives, you know how it is, sweaty and dirty and hot, these archives, the name Spreckles kept popping up. Spreckles this, Spreckles that. Oh, I met Mr. Spreckles today. All this. I go, I know that name. Being born and raised in San Diego, I lived with my grandmother across from the Spreckles Theater. And I'm like, Spreckles. So anyway, I just kept it for the side. So all that to say is about 7 books came from that one attic in Berkeley. What? All came. It was just such a blessing to my life.
Okay, we're going to spend a lot of time with Spreckles here in a minute, but one more question on Ida, because there's a lot of debates around how to frame things like the mission system, Native American boarding schools, not only in the United States, but also in Canada. And obviously there was a lot of horrible things that happened, but then there's also just the tragedy of just well-intentioned people trying to improve the world, but doing harmful things as an outcome of that. And so I guess my question is, what did learning about her life and how she approached Native American education, did that challenge or alter your perspective on Native American boarding schools? And what do those kind of broad narratives about what happened with them, what did they get wrong maybe based on your perspective and studying this specific case study?
Now, you're talking about Native Americans and not Native Hawaiians?
Yeah. So Native people. So in other words,
people, period.
Native people have been acculturated through different mechanisms in different places, but there's some broad through lines with them, which is pulling them into a certain environment, educating them in certain kind of Western ways. And I was just curious about how your research affected the way you see that kind of discussion.
We have to go with, in 1820, the first missionaries went over to Hawaii with a very different purpose. It took 6 months to get from Boston to Honolulu, for example. So they learned Hawaiian along the way. It was very important to them that they were going to minister to the people, serve the people in their own language, learn their words, learn their language. They then had children, right? Because it was like 12 different companies over 20 years that went. But their children, the first missionaries' descendants, they decided they're going to make the Hawaiians Americans because they were superior. So all the shift changed. It's tragically, in my opinion, that got up to Ida Pope's time where then it was illegal. You could not speak Hawaiian in Hawaii. What? It's just nonsensical, but I struggle with that, especially with American Girl in the Hawaiian Islands, the first book I wrote on the Carrie Winter I spoke about. The beatings that took place of those children, the whipping when they caught them speaking Hawaiian, they were whipped. The first time I read some different letters, I have other letters from actually the Hawaiian monarchy kids and the chief's children's school. I cried. I'm a mom. Teacher and a grandmother, you're whipping children like this? It's horrifying. Ida May Polk comes in a different generation. She went to Oberlin. Her generation, the first women to get an education in a co-ed environment, they came in and says, I want to elevate Hawaiians, but I don't want to take their culture from them. So it was going back. But there was a whole swath of Hawaiian history where I'm horrified the things I've read. I'm just horrified. There's a man named Amos Cook and his wife, Juliet Cook. They were selected by King Kamehameha, I think it was the second, to be a teacher of every child that was eligible to rule the kingdom someday, were pulled out, isolated from the rest of their population, and schooled together in the chief's children's school. This man, now we know, had Huntington's disease. He was crazy. And so his beatings of these children and the inoculations of the drugs they gave, I'm almost wondering if there's some sexual things going on. I edited his diaries, 10 years of this man's diaries. Oh my gosh. Now I wonder. So then when I look at how easy it was to take, Queen Liliuokalani was a child in that school, and so was King Kalakaua. How easy it was for these Americans to come in and take the country from them. If you go back to their education and what happened to them, they were denied everything, food even, connections. It's just horrible. And some of my missionary teachers also taught in Native American schools here in America. And Lila Appleton is one of them. She chronicled both, she compared too, and I'm horrified on both levels. But so it's, what are you gonna say? It is what it is. It's horrible. But, there's so much pain and suffering today. And where's the healing? Where's the healing? We need people to be healed.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it is important for people that go to Hawaii and just want a vacation and drink Mai Tais to understand that it's a complicated history, of course, like every place is, but in particular. So let's jump to the Spreckles now. I want to start with the son, and then we'll get to the father, going in the order in which your books were published. So I have some questions outside of chronological biography, just things that interest me about John Dee that I want to hear you talk about. And the first one, obviously, is the Hotel Del Coronado, which I grew up going to. My grandparents lived in El Cajon most of my life. And so we would take our car down and we'd drive down. And when we'd get there, eventually we'd be at the Hotel Del for something at some point. It was like a ritual almost, like a pilgrimage that would take place every time we go down there. And I just remember wandering through the building and just being fascinated by the structure and the design, and felt like something that I would see. It reminded me of recently, I've been enjoying that show on HBO, The Gilded Age, where they're bringing back some of that beautiful Victorian architecture in a way where you can picture what it was like in the 1880s, 1890s, early 1900s, see that time period. And when you're at the hotel, you feel really transported. So why did he want to build that hotel? And what was interesting for me is learning about is all the, which makes sense now, all the challenges with constructing that hotel, whether it's water or materials or those kinds of things. So can you give us the backstory there?
I sure can. And I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but John D. Spreckles did not build the Hotel Del Coronado. He did not. Elisha Babcock and Hampton Story and some, they built the hotel. They began in 1887 after buying the entire peninsula. They began building the hotel, and it was when California was in our boom period. So it was like everybody was buying lots. They were platting it out. They had all Coronado Island and the hotel getting ready to go. And when they were done with the Hotel Del Coronado in 1888, it only took 11 months to build that hotel. Hampton Story wanted out. So did the investors. The boom had bust. we don't have time to go into that boom and bust of California, yeah. But Southern California, it was a pretty big deal. So our population went down. Everyone got out of here. We had no water to drink here anyway, down here in thirsty San Diego, but people got out. But Elisha Babcock knew a very rich man named John D. Spreckles, who had already come down here on his private yacht from San Francisco and liked what he saw down here. Mr. Spreckles, how would you like to invest in this beautiful hotel on this island? You can buy out Hampton Story, all the investors. You and I can be joint partners, says Elisha. Needs $100,000. John D. Spreckles makes all these deals. He says yes. He sees a good opportunity, and there's no bust. He doesn't live in Southern California. His fortune's in Hawaii and San Francisco. So he's not impacted. How much do you need? I'll buy everyone out. So within 5 years, Elisha Babcock could not pay John D. Spreckles back. So John D. Spreckles became the owner of the entire island. The ferries, the train, everything that was Elisha Babcock's dream was now owned by John D. Spreckles. And he kept on Elijah Babcock as the manager of his dream. It's sad if you look at it like that, because John D. Spreckels still lived in San Francisco when he took over Coronado Hotel. Now, the Hotel del Coronado, was its vision was initially to be like a man's man hotel, beautiful Queen Anne Victorian on the outside, hunting in the inside, masculine. John D. Spreckels was a shipping magnate at the time. His father had already developed the new port of the Pacific up in Aptos and developed a hotel. He had hotel experience. He wanted that place to be luxurious, bring in this everything. He finished the fine touches, the beautiful paintings, the furniture, everything changed. The train came in and rich men now were coming across the country, because Spreckels at the time was a household name. Spreckels Sugar was pretty big. And so anything John D. Spreckels owns it, let's go. And that's how it came. But the Spreckels were the longest owners in the Hotel del Coronado's history. So everything that you see today, that's historic, was him. Sorry he didn't build it.
Yeah, no, I got my facts wrong, and thanks for correcting me. The next question I have about his influence on local media in San Diego, the owner of the Tribune, how did he use that paper? What was it for him?
Well, he wanted to control the narrative. Now, at the time, he owned the San Francisco Call as well. So the San Francisco Call's in San Francisco. He bought the Union. I believe it was 1900. I've written three books since then. It was 1900. He buys the Union, the San Diego Union. And now people are like, who in the world is this upstart buying our paper? Bound here. All the businessmen hated it. How dare he? He was promoting himself and all his, he started investing in San Diego heavily. And people were not happy, the people that were here. So anyways, after he bought the Union, the San Diego Tribune began criticizing him big time. So John D. Spreckels had to solve that problem real quick. He bought the Tribune as well in a decade later. So now today we have the San Diego Union Tribune. He had to control the narrative. He did not. And John D. Spreckels, unlike his father, was a shy, introverted man. You only heard him when he published something in the newspaper. So he needed it as his voice as well.
Why did he want to build a giant pipe organ?
Like father, like son. His father had already given what's today in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. They called it in the day the music stand. What's it called today? The bandshell, where all the concerts are today?
Yeah, that sounds right.
His father gave it to San Francisco. John D. Spreckels gave the organ pavilion to San Diego. Like father. Now, if you spoke to 1,000 San Diegans, people would not know that there's another one. It's just like it up in San Francisco in Golden Park.
So to be honest, I didn't know that myself.
No, I show them side by side on a PowerPoint, because now I'm out promoting my new book. So I showed it on PowerPoint going, what's this? And everything. Oh, that's the organ pavilion. No, it's not. These Spreckels were very competitive. So was he competing with his father's legacy, or was he following suit? I don't know. But I will tell you this. John D. Spreckels played the organ beautifully. He loved music. He was very artistic. So part of that was love as well for music.
So when you were promoting that previous book, what was the San Diego reception? What's his legacy there? And is he front of mind for some people? Or is he, like you said before, one of these, I wouldn't classify him as a pioneer by any means, but early founding figures that set the course for a city? What's his legacy in San Diego today?
I would argue that San Diego was not developed in the way where you up there. We were pretty undeveloped. So he was a pioneer. When John D. came down here, our transportation system was full. We just stayed right around downtown. That's where it was. Old Town, New Town, Horton, all those names growing up here. But there were mules pulling these carts around with people. He pioneered transportation. He gave San Diego's entire network system of this streetcar, so when that we could now develop suburbs. If it weren't for him pioneering this technology, we wouldn't even have had suburbs as early. People wouldn't have got out and stayed. He also built dams. He built three dams here. We had no water. People don't know that until Empire Builder came out. So now I'm constantly being asked by places like SOHO, Save Our Heritage Organization, San Diego's asked me to present Empire Builder and John's legacy in January to kick off. And I'm delighted that people now, since the book, it came out in 2020, but it's taken this many years for book clubs to read it. It's now going into audiobook for people to actually think, wow, why isn't there more for John D. Spreckles in San Diego? If you go to Coronado, we have Spreckles Park. Concerts are there all summer. We have the John D. Spreckles Center. We have his mansion. You can see, you leave Coronado, not so much. So he's still forgotten for the general public, but Empire Builder book is restoring his legacy. He built our city and gets little thanks for it. People think, oh, he's a right-wing Republican businessman who just got his way. Wrong. He gave the exposition, the Balboa Park, the beautiful Balboa Park, $200,000. And ultimately, $350,000 he put into our beautiful Balboa Park. And that money, I wonder, what is that today's money? There's nothing to him for him in Balboa Park, but he's appreciated beauty. He gave us our first park here, Mission Cliff Gardens in San Diego. He didn't live here, but he wanted music. He wanted beauty. He loved beauty. He was an artist and a musician besides being this businessman, and he was shy. And people have not seen him like that. So I present a very holistic look at this man who was the son of a powerful guy. And he was often like chip off the old block. Some ways, yes. Some ways, no.
That's a perfect transition, because I want to talk about Klaus for a while now. So I've got a number of questions, but I want to start with primary sources. As a person with a history background and working in this space, I love to talk about sources and source-related questions. I was curious about your experiences working with German genealogists. I read that in an article about your book, and I speak some German myself, and I know that there's challenges with that language. Yeah. Can you talk about some of the interesting primary source experiences, but also your experience working with German geologists, what that was like?
Okay. So if not plural, just one.
Singular. Got it.
I discovered very early on the man named Uwe Spiekermann. And Uwe is E-W-E. I had to say that. Uwe Spiekermann has got a couple of doctorates. He's a businessman. He's into health and medicine and genealogy, and specifically Spreckles family. So I can't remember his credentials here, but at this exact moment in time, but he had already begun doing research on the Spreckles family in Germany. He was fascinated about what he called his German robber baron, which I argue with him all the time. He's not a robber baron. He doesn't fit the American profile.
Oh, gosh. You are already predicting a question I have for you in a little bit. So we'll circle back to what a robber baron is here in a minute, but please continue.
Yes. Uwe, he had done the genealogy. He has been to every spot Klaus Spreckles and his sons have touched worldwide. He's been to the village in Lambstead in northern Hanover. And he's met the uncles and the cousins and the blah, blah. So whenever I needed to get something accurate, first I asked him if we could do a Zoom so we could meet each other because we had similar interests. He was dumbfounded. This American woman like myself was interested in this German, what he called a robber baron. And so began a long friendship since about 2018. I adore this man, and he's as sharp as a tack. So if I'm going to, he knows the birth dates of all the descendants. Like last week, someone contacted me thinking they were related to Klaus Spreckles, their cousin Peter. I quickly sent an email, Uwe, yes or no? He says, absolutely not. Peter Spreckles lived to blah, blah, blah. So he's been very helpful with me with the pronunciations of things, with the context, with what did that village look like? What does a tenant farmer look like to me in Germany, Uwe? Was he prosperous? How does that look? He was able to walk me through the areas I can't go living in California. He's been incredibly helpful. He wrote the foreword for Empire Builder book. So really great. Most of my primary sources for the Spreckles family came out of meeting the descendants, tracking them down. They don't know each other because what happened with the lawsuits. Their ancestors sued the pants off each other, and there's the haves and the have-nots. And part of my mission in writing this book was to introduce the cousins to each other. The kissing cousins is what they think. They told a newspaper journalist one time, we're now kissing cousins thanks to Sandy. So I'm still finding them. I've got a Facebook page. When I find them and they, here, let me put you here. It's closed. Let's get you in touch. And so I've been in a many a home in Northern California and in Arizona, looking through shopping bags full of letters and photos, old suitcases and trunks. It's been an incredible journey. I wanted to find the voice. But as the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco, I'm writing about a family whose life was in San Francisco and everything was burned up in the 1906 fire. So hadn't been for some of the places in Hawaii when some of the Hawaiian royalty talked about the Spreckles family. Do I get to hear this about the shenanigans? But unfortunately, finding correspondence and things, it's tough. It's really tough to find primary sources for the Spreckles family because of that horrible tragedy.
Let's talk a little bit more about Klaus and his relationship to sugar. One of his major achievements was a sugar refining factory in San Francisco and being able to process so much refined sugar. Obviously, we're talking about this in a world now that has a complicated relationship with sugar. I do personally. I'm sure many listeners also do. It's interesting to write about something that, you know, where the kind of the subject matter, it's fascinating to watch the development, but you're also thinking about the long-term impacts of the way refined sugar have changed the world. How do you think about that particular subject?
Yeah, sometimes I hide my head. If it's any solace, poor Klaus Spreckles had diabetes.
And so makes sense to me.
Yeah, makes sense to me too. Yeah, sugar. Nobody eats sugar like Americans. And they don't even come close. Statistics of other countries don't even come. The second is Europe, and they don't even come close to us. We're horrible. So yeah, thank you, Klaus. I appreciate that. But they didn't know. And for Klaus, he wanted his gift to be, because of his spicy dealings with the Hawaii, talk about saint or sinner, he's not looked kindly right now in some camps, how he accrued the land. He owned royal land when nobody could own royal land, and he got it by dubious methods.
Yeah. I was going to bring up, and you can talk about this now if you'd, I was going to talk about his impacts on the island I like to visit the most, which is Maui, and how some of his activities affected the island.
And he built a huge, he diverted water. I'd have to consult my facts, but he diverted water from Haleakala. Probably you've been to Haleakala if you love Maui. It's the dormant volcano on the top. So he diverted the water from the top of Haleakala so it could trickle all the way down to the isthmus of Maui, the dry, arid Maui, so he could water his crops. When he diverted, if you go to the road for Hana, you can still see pieces of that ditch. We call it the Spreckles Ditch, but it's not a ditch. It is a complicated series of flumes, and it is.
I've driven past, and I never went, but I've driven past that sugar museum there, right in the center and the isthmus. Have you been to that particular place?
Let me tell you something. Klaus was not the first person to build that ditch. And to develop, he was number two, but his enemies were number one, the Baldwin family. So that museum, they have erased Spreckles' history out of it. They have erased him out of the books. They hated him. He hated them. So when Klaus discovered Maui and knew he was going to build a plantation there and get his own source of sugar, there was already another guys doing it. They were the missionary descendants we talked about early. And they were, here comes Klaus Spreckles, portly Klaus Spreckles with his cigar, unschooled, not educated, didn't go to church. They love to say he didn't go to church in Hawaii, because that was their whole social life was. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. But when he developed that ditch, he diverted water, and it really hurt the small local native farmers from their own poi farms and their own taro fields. why is all that water going to these sugarcane fields? But he was number two, not number one. He just did it bigger and better. So there's a lot of controversy today about the big Maui fire. Where was the water? Where was the water?
Yeah. Let's just jump into the robber baron discussion because I think it's worth having. And I think it's complicated, right? Because every robber baron or every titan of industry or business magnate, whatever term we want to use, is different and unique in their own ways. John D. Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie are different, but there are some through lines. There are some things about that we can connect them with, obviously. So why would you say he's not a robber baron?
If I think of Carnegie, just as Carnegie as an example here, his workers hated him. He thought they needed to read a book more than they needed a chicken on their table at night. He treated his workers terrible. I'm not making that up. You can read on it. Klaus Spreckels workers, they started with Klaus and they died with Klaus. His workers were, he was so loyal to his workers. Everyone wanted to work for Klaus Spreckels. Nobody wanted to work for Carnegie. He elevated his men. He fought for his men. He didn't like unions, but who did in that era? But it was a rough era. There was no roadmap to follow, especially for an immigrant like he was. He just had to just bare knuckle, get in there and get his way. And he liked things done the best way. So he didn't go and take over industries. He developed new industries and developed them better. So we get your oil people back. Who did you just mention?
I mentioned John D. Rockefeller. Yeah.
Rockefeller. Go and take and absorb all these little companies, and these big trusts were huge in that era. It was vicious and cruel what robber barons did to their competition. Klaus Spreckels didn't do that. He didn't go and buy out his rivals and take them over by nefarious means. He just developed. For instance, when he got the sugarcane, he developed the Oceanic Shipping Line, the first shipping line to go from San Francisco to the Pacific carrying the American flag. We're going to take my sugar cane in style. He didn't take over the slow moving blah blahs. They still stayed there. They still stayed in business. He wasn't interested in taking over other people's industries. He's going to make another one and it's going to be bigger and better and cheaper for the people. That's where he shines differently. He built five railroads in his time. Railroads. Five. Think about that for a second. That's huge. He did that to save the people of California money. The Southern Pacific was a hated monopoly. Hated. And Klaus Spreckels went direct in direct competition to them. In fact, one of his railroads went from San Joaquin Valley down to Bakersfield. It was called the People's Railroad because he built it so people can afford to transport their goods. He teamed up with Levi Strauss, by the way, to do that. Klaus wanted to get his sugar out. Levi wanted to get his jeans out. Other people wanted to get their wheat up from Bakersfield and their corn. Now they could do it cost efficiently. I don't know how you can look to these other guys and even make a comparison. Everything he did was better. And so the governor of California once said, Klaus Spreckels' success is California's success. Let him do whatever he wants. He was employing the most people. He was building the most people. He was, wow, I never knew what I was getting into when I wrote his biography. It's 400,000 pages. It could have been more than 400 pages when I couldn't be limited to 100,000 words with this guy. I told my editor, I'm sorry, you have to do it yourself. I can't help it if what he got his hands into. I had no idea. It's pretty astounding that one person did that. Now he had some nervous breakdowns along the way and having get himself into a health spa.
He also gave me some cavities, I'm sure, but that's a subject for a different day. I want to pull back and take a 20,000 foot perspective. How has the work and research you've done on these books changed your perspective on California history?
Oh, wow. I didn't realize the plight of California. When I was researching Klaus's book, when I was trying to get inspired to see if I was going to write the book in the first place, I traveled up to the Salinas Valley and went to the little company town of Spreckels, which today still exists. It's a company town, but it's with historical designation. So it was built in 1898. It looks just like it is. You can't touch it. Monterey County, historical designated town. And when I started interviewing people, going into their homes, people live today in the same homes that people came from Hawaii. Oh, my great-grandfather came from Hawaii. The houses just keep passing down. When I started meeting these hard-working farming people, I had never interacted with farming people. I grew up in San Diego. We had some tuna fishermen here, and we just didn't have farms here that I knew about. I began such a respect of the whole agricultural. Now, Klaus Spreckels turned a brown valley green. So John Steinbeck filmed a lot of his films there in the town of Spreckels, and his father worked for the Spreckels factory. So when that whole swath today is the salad bowl of America, and the way it got to be there was thank you to Klaus Spreckels for irrigating that valley so we could have the lettuce and strawberries that we have today. But for me, I have gained such a respect for farmers, the descendants of farmers, the hard work. I'm embarrassed that I never acknowledged the hard work of the agricultural in the middle of our state. Where you live, where there used to be sugar beets.
See, oh, yeah.
All this was because of Klaus Spreckels. He wanted his parting gift to America to be what he wanted to give California the muscle and to stand out with the rest of the nation, and how he's going to do that with beet sugar. We don't need to be dependent on other countries. We're going to make refined sugar from beets, not cane, beets. And today I'm informed by a very good source that 60% of the nation gets their sugar today from beets, and the other part cane. You and I live in California, we're getting cane sugar. We live in Colorado, it's beet sugar. So it just depends on where it is. So meeting people in the sugar industry and researching them today, it's just changed me. I love California before. Now I love it more. And I feel like I can travel any part of the state right now and know so much more. And I'm just so blessed to have found this unspoken pioneer who's made makes me want to be better. I didn't fall in love with John D. Spreckels really writing his book, but I sure fell in love with his dad. And when I fell in love with his dad is when he wanted to build Watsonville in the Salinas Valley. That's when I fell in love with him, when he put his overalls back on and said, farmers, let's work together. We're poor. Let's go. Look at me. I'm with you. I'm going to buy your seed. If it doesn't work, we'll give it to the animals and you'll still get paid. And I start going, I love this guy. He's so well. Because Hawaii, I'm like, you did what? Really? Now I'm like, I love you.
Yeah. People that I've talked to that have written extensive biographies like that have described it almost feeling like they're added a member to their family because they're so intimate and close. We could probably talk about Klaus for a long time, but I want to close today with my favorite section, which is book recommendations. What are a few books you'd recommend to listeners?
Ooh, wow. I'm not sure I'd be the best person because I have not stopped writing since 2008.
Okay.
Boom. Now, I believe I've written another book, that's not out. But I'm not writing any more books. I don't think I'm done. I think I just need to take care of Sandy for a little while, get away from the computer and read books. So then when someone asks me, what would I recommend? I'm like, oh, let me tell you. So no, I have my favorite fiction authors I ride on the bike at the gym. But other than that, I couldn't tell you.
Okay. Sandy, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me and for your work. It's been fascinating to explore someone that grew up hanging around Hotel Del and around San Diego and learning some of that history, but also the broader history of the West. So thanks again for doing this.
You're welcome. And please come down to San Diego and I'll give you a private tour of the Hotel Del.
Oh, I would love that. That would be fantastic.
Thanks
for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time. Thank you.